Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our guest today has made it his mission to bring American literature, history, poetry, storytelling into the public sphere. We're talking with John Peede, chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. He'll be in New Hampshire next week to give the commencement address at Manchester Community College. Chairman Peede will also give a talk about the humanities' importance in rural communities. And today in The Exchange, we catch up with him in advance of his Granite State visit. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Chairman Peede joins us from a studio at NPR Washington. Chairman Peede, welcome. Really nice to have you.
Thank you, Laura. It's my pleasure.
Well, I'm going to start off really basic with you. What are the humanities? I think there's still some confusion about what that term exactly means.
Yes, I think it's because it's so much. I start with this. If people ask what the humanities are, I say, for example, it's history. If they've seen a Ken Burns film on PBS, they're experiencing the humanities. If they've read a book of history, if they've read a work of literature, philosophy, religion, archaeology, the humanities in the university are considered the liberal arts. But really, if you think of there, the sciences and the humanities, and that's in many ways how we divide knowledge, particularly in the United States. And if the sciences teaches about the making of the world, the humanities teaches about what do we want our lives to be in the world? What meaning do we want to draw from existence itself? And so the humanities, it seems to me, are rather vital, not just to the individual, but to the society at large.
How often do you find yourself, Chairman Peede, explaining what the humanities are, what the National Endowment for the Humanities is? Do most Americans get what this is?
I don't think so, honestly. Quite often, again, I just say the humanities equal history as a starting point because that's something that people understand quite clearly. But here's what's important. It's not about whether people understand the mission of the National Endowment for the Humanities at a detailed level. It's that they understand the humanities are in their lives every day. And if they experience things as a voter, as they're trying to decide about politics, well, government, political science, these are humanistic fields. And so I spend a lot more time thinking about, do they have access to great museums? Do they have access to public radio documentaries? Do they have public libraries that are well-resourced? So a lot of my energy and my colleagues at the endowment is focused on making sure people have the humanities in their lives. And if they don't always understand it under those terms, that's okay with me. The more important thing is that they have a rich cultural experience around them.
How about younger generations, Chairman Peede? How engaged do you see them? How engaged are they in the humanities?
Well, I think the main point is they're experiencing the humanities in very different ways. So, for example, I grew up in the American South, and I read Walden Pond as a book, never went there. Now, on the other hand, school kids from across the country, instead of experiencing it just as a book, they have a chance to have an immersive game that we've funded that allows people to interact in that community. So we are trying to make sure that the humanities are available in lots of platforms, books, films, podcasts, videos, augmented reality experiences. And I think that's important. There are lots of ways of learning, and we should, as an endowment, be open to funding all of them.
That's interesting. So you don't have to be reading an 800-page book or watching a 16-hour documentary. You can still be engaging in the humanities, even if it's quicker, shorter, or digital.
Absolutely. Right now I'm reading Jill Lepore's History of the United States. I think in book form it's some 800 or 900 pages. I've been reading it on an airplane, you know, for the last month. I'm reading it on my phone because, you know, I can only carry so many books with me on these trips. And I say it as somebody who's a book collector. I love the feel of books in my hands, but I need to, you know, acquire that knowledge in a more accessible way in terms of my travel. And so, again, I think we shouldn't draw lines and say this is an acceptable way to be educated and this way is not. We need to look at that generation, that person and their occupation, and see what works best for that person.
I want to ask you, Chairman Petey, about the Endowment for Humanities' involvement with programming around veterans. And we've seen a lot of that here in New Hampshire. We have a relatively high percentage of our population has served in the military or is currently serving in the military. Where did this get started, Chairman Petey? You were very much involved in engaging veterans in the arts and humanities.
Yes, I think it's so important to the Humanities Endowment, and it has been in my career. And before I say something about my own interaction, I really want to call out the New Hampshire Humanities team under Anthony Poor. They have done a great job of making sure that humanities programming is available across the state, and in particular have focused on veterans. So 40% of our federal budget is dispersed to our state and territorial partners, which is wonderful because they're in every community, every county. So a peculiar thing happened to me, a really transformative thing in my career. And it happened in Manchester, New Hampshire. In April of 2003, I was a speechwriter and advisor to the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, to Dana Gioia, a great poet, a great chairman of the Arts Endowment. And I'd just been with the agency a couple of weeks. I'd known the chairman for about a decade. And he was in New Hampshire for the state poet laureates gathering. So all across the country, all these poets, and I'll be honest, is, you know, a hotel, it's about midnight, everybody's at the bar, these are poets after all, and one poet, Marilyn Nelson, daughter of Tuskegee Airmen, you know, that's the all-African-American
right.
fighter corps in World War II, and she is a pacifist, and it was during the Iraq War, and she was teaching at West Point. She was teaching poetry. West Point had adopted one of her books as all the cadets were reading. And she said, "My cadets are now going to war, Dana, and I don't want them to experience what my classmates experienced coming back from Vietnam in terms of not being welcomed by their communities." And she felt very important. And Chairman Gioia said, "Well, if we could get some poets and novelists that won't bring their politics onto camp onto the bases, let's talk about wartime writing. Let's remind them that American veterans have always written about war." And I was asked to run it, and we thought we might do it for, you know, a few months while the war went on. In the end, I spent 8 years of my life running that project from 2003 to 2011. Ran in Afghanistan, Bahrain, Kyrgyzstan, about 30 domestic bases. And we have veterans from World War II, such as Shelby Foote, who recorded statements, Richard Wilbur. We had Vietnam veterans such as Tobias Wolff, who actually taught the writing workshops. And the book that came out of it was called Operation Homecoming, edited by Andrew Carroll. And in that year, we started the Big Read at the Arts Endowment, the Shakespeare Initiative. So I really ended up working on three literary projects, and that shaped a great deal of my career. And so now, more than 15 years later, I have the privilege of leading the Humanities Endowment, and we have dedicated funding lines to support veterans and active duty troops and their families. And so that's really made a difference. And it all started because one person, a poet at an event in New Hampshire, said, "What if?"
I had not heard that story before. I heard the story about how this Veterans Project got started, but I did not know that it happened in Manchester, where you will be next week giving the commencement speech at Manchester Community College. So I want to ask you a couple more questions, actually, Chairman Petey, about that Veterans Project. But let me remind our listeners that you can join us today in the exchange. Our guest is John Petey. He is the chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. And as I said, he'll be in New Hampshire next week discussing the importance of the humanities in rural America and giving the commencement address at Manchester Community College. We'd love your questions and comments about the humanities and its role in your life. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter @nhprexchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. A few more questions for you, please, Chairman Petey, on that Veterans Project. What was that like for you to go to those bases all around the world, all around the country, and work with veterans on their own personal narratives?
It was powerful. It's something that sometimes in life, the great things that happen, you only recognize in retrospect. I think every moment I was involved with that, I knew how much of a gift it was. It was cathartic for the troops, for our workshop teachers, for those of us that were on that team at the Arts Endowment. And I can't overstate how just incredibly dedicated the NEH and NEA staff are. And it was, what was wonderful about it is you would see works of literature, including, for example, the Iliad and the Odyssey, being read by troops in combat zones in a way that made the books alive in a way that it might rarely be in a classroom. And that's why I'm not always so worried if somebody says, well, the majors in English are down or history are down. The humanities are so essential and so important, and they're beyond the walls of our universities. And in fact, I think in many ways it's our community colleges that understand that best and have these wonderful relationships with museums, with public, you know, speaking events, with libraries. And it's, I'm hard-pressed to talk about one particular story. I will say that the troops ultimately gave us 10,000 pages of writing.
Wow.
And in a book, we could only put, you know, 400 or 500 pages in it. And the rest is all of it's at the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress now. And turning people down, I think that was incredibly hard thing to do. Trying to drive home the fact that their story mattered, whether or not it was in the book. And I was once in Bagram, Afghanistan, in a hospital, and I thought I was there with the patients as my focus, the troops that had been injured in some manner. And it was when we were talking about it and reading prior works of American literature to bring out these stories from the current troops that I looked over, and the nurse couldn't continue to talk. She was weeping, and the doctors were themselves very emotional, and it reminded me again that in a combat zone, everybody is in need of that cathartic therapeutic experience. It was the chaplains, for example, that always welcomed us to the bases because they understood that we were part of what they were trying to do.
What did the veterans say about this project, this writing project that you brought to them all over the world and all over the country, especially in a combat zone, Chairman Petey? I'm wondering if people thought, Are you kidding me? Writing? You know, I've got a very serious job to do right now. This is a combat zone.
Well, I will say early on, both the Defense Department and the Arts Endowment thought that we did not need to be in the combat zone, that we would meet people at Walter Reed Army Hospital or on domestic bases.
After the fact.
And there were some practical elements of this about developing writing skills and things of this nature, and the ability to express themselves better. It was better for marriage counseling. It was better for reduction of suicidal thoughts and other things. But as the war went on longer and longer, the idea of some level of some form of intervention for those in combat, if they desired it, that's something that both we and DOD thought was of value. And to be clear, we were reaching thousands and thousands, against, a million and more deployed. So percentage-wise, we were not reaching people at the level that that the formal parts, such as the chaplains, do. But it was impactful, and it also allowed chances for the civilian population to hear directly from the troops. And I'll say now, in terms of two things, where are we today on these kind of things? Well, at the Humanities Endowment, for example, our funding of the New Hampshire Humanities Council, they awarded a nearly $80,000 grant for dialogues and the experience of war. And so that discussion program had veterans, and it was focused on the Odyssey and then also contemporary literature about war. And that was in Concord. And that's just an example. And we've done those across the country. And this is in addition, again, to films, not just Ken Burns films, but also Rick Burns films that have been about veteran experiences. And then at the Arts Endowment, that project Operation Homecoming is now called Creative Forces.
And so it's ongoing. It is.
Now it's in the Intrepid Center, and the military is looking at arts therapy. So that's music therapy, dance therapy, and movement therapy, and other therapies, including writing in a different way, to see what impact it has on the wellness, the physical and mental wellness of troops. So that's in a very clinically evaluated, controlled environment, and the military is establishing the protocols for that. So it's been great to see these two endowments complement each other, and that is a point of pride for me. We have some other things that are in the works here. Let me just say that we are talking to lieutenant governors across the nation, for example, about how we might serve those who were in the National Guard and now return to civilian life, and how we might help them share their experiences.
So the humanities is part of the processing of wartime experience and wartime trauma.
Absolutely, it is.
We did a whole program, by the way, on this program that you had in, or that the New Hampshire Humanities had, called Troy to Baghdad, and it was about returning veterans, processing their experience. It was a wonderful program, and if listeners want to go back and check that program out, it is on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. It was a wonderful program. We had two veterans here, along with the woman who ran the program here in New Hampshire. And that show that we did won several national awards, so that was gratifying for us as well. We will talk more after a short break. Chairman Petey, I want to ask about your own involvement in the humanities and what you're going to say when you're in New Hampshire about the importance of the humanities in rural America. So all that's coming up. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Thank you. The main reason I decided to incorporate NHPR into my estate planning is because it absolutely is an essential part of my day.
Robert Cody of Deerfield.
Doing so with an IRA account is a very tax-efficient way of transferring your assets to the future.
Fund the future of NHPR by naming us as a beneficiary to your IRA. Learn more about this and other plan giving options at nhpr.giveplans.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're talking with the chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, John Peedy. He's joining us from D.C., but he'll be in New Hampshire next week talking about the importance of the humanities in rural America and giving the commencement address at Manchester Community College. If you have questions about what the humanities are or comments about the role they play in your life, in your community, as always, we'd love to hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is NHPR Exchange, and our phone number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Chairman Peedy, write to our listeners, and Steve's calling from Nottingham. Hi, Steve, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, and I want to thank you not only for the national but the local, what we do in New Hampshire, what I'm so thrilled with. New Hampshire is like a series of city-states, and people, when they're home at night, don't go out. We're not like New York City or Boston. So the fact that you guys are local, the events are in my local library or the community center, means it's accessible to people. I've been to many of your programs, like on Galileo or with Benedict Arnold or Trader or not. But the fact it was in my hometown and it was accessible is the big shout-out I want to give to you and what it does for New Hampshire.
Thank you very much for calling in, Steve. And this is kind of your mission, isn't it, Chairman Peedy, taking this out of the ivory tower and bringing it to the community?
Absolutely. I think the humanities being in our communities, it's the only way I can understand the humanities really functioning. They're essential in our universities. Of course, they are the foundation of the university. But take our state humanities partners, for example. The population of the state, I believe, last time I checked, is around 1.3 million, something of that nature. The New Hampshire humanities reaches, they estimate, about 145,000 people a year. Imagine one nonprofit, a small team, talented team, reaching 10% of the entire population. That's a remarkable achievement. And when I talk about some of the things I want to do as chairman, I want to, one, reinforce what your caller's saying, this idea that it's got to have a local programming that, yes, there are these large national stories, but, for example, we're spending a lot of time around the issue of civics education, and we're thinking about the year 2026, the 250th year of nationhood. And so when I'm in New Hampshire, to be in the first state to have a state constitution, the first state to declare independence from England, you can see how important your state history plays into the national history. And by the way, when I talk about the founding of the nation, that also means that we need to tell a more comprehensive story about the indigenous people, about Native Americans, and their history and their ongoing history in this nation. So,
and you funded some programs toward that end.
Absolutely, we have, and certainly look to do more. And we have a number of areas, not just, of course, our state humanities partners, but also the New Hampshire Historical Society we funded. And, of course, we have past grants to the Athenaeum and other projects. But the Humanities on the Go, for example, the statewide speakers program, the Bureau has some 400 programs each year. And so I appreciate your caller reinforcing that's really making a difference. So that's encouraging to hear.
Steve, thank you for that call. And again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Since you mentioned history, Chairman Petey, you have said in earlier interviews that what keeps you up at night is that, I'm quoting here, we Americans don't understand our history. What's lacking in our knowledge? What don't we understand?
Well, I don't think we have comprehensive knowledge. I think we just have huge gaps in knowledge. And also, I think sometimes that we don't allow for a nuanced conversation. And what I mean by that is, I think our founding documents and our founders brought a remarkable governmental experiment into the world. It's never been equaled since. And at the same time, we have to be able to acknowledge the moral failings, largely around slavery, for example. And that means that if we want to talk about the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, that fight for independence, then we need to also talk about Frederick Douglass is a clarifier of what it means to be American and who was left out. And then we need to talk about the 19th Amendment, which we funded a PBS documentary. That's the women's right to vote, which we're coming up on the centennial of the suffrage movement. And so it's the idea that that you can admire your country and be patriotic and also be aware of times we weren't our best selves. When we turned away from what Lincoln called us to be, which is the better angels of our nature. And often when I think I wanted a statement by one of the founders, I wanted something for the colonial period that I thought guided some of my thinking. And I wanted something from the 20th century literature, my own area of literary focus. And so I had two remarks. One is what Thomas Jefferson said in an 1816 letter. And again, he was a flawed vessel for delivering this wisdom, but we're all flawed. And he said, a nation that expects to be ignorant and free in a state of civilization expects what never was and will never be. And so that's the charge of the Humanities Endowment, to push back against ignorance, to preserve freedom. And also, on the other side of that, whenever I worry that we're getting too in the weeds, too esoteric, academic in our thinking, I go back to the African-American novelist, folklorist, Zora Neale Hurston. And she said, research is formalized curiosity. And I love that. Mm. I think about what my colleagues and I are doing. You know, Laura, you and your colleagues up there at the studio, you're trying to bring knowledge to the citizens every day of your state. And so we're in the business of curiosity.
On this idea that you raised, Chairman Petey, of we need a deeper understanding, a fuller understanding of our history, some people listening, I'm sure, would say, yes, we should look at the shining example that our country offers, but also probe in those dark corners. But some people these days, Chairman Petey, say, hey, stop being so politically correct with our country. I wonder what you think about that, you know, don't offer alternative views of this history, you're sort of bowing to the gods of political correctness. There's that theme out there, too. So how do you balance that?
I come back. I'll quote a French writer, André Gide. He said something, I don't remember in the French, but in English. He said, don't understand me too quickly. I think that's essential. I worry about the erosion of civility, which means the erosion of some kind of sense of goodwill. I'll say this way. I've been married 20-something years. My wife and I are absolutely in love with each other. So because we're so committed to that marriage, we can say, boy, John, you know, should have cleaned up more, or I forgot to do this or that. You know, the idea that you can critique what you love because you're secure in that relationship, right? That's how I feel about the country I love. that the humanities say to me that I can acknowledge the moral failure of slavery in America. I can acknowledge the stain of how long it took for what the civil rights we were fighting for. Now we look at it and think, well, of course we are all equal. And the idea that that wasn't recognized, you know, in remarkable nations across the world, such things weren't recognized. And so I think the humanities call us to have an informed, again, nuanced understanding of the world. But to critique, you know, a nation is not the same as to dishonor it. I consider myself very much in the humanities and rather patriotic, and I don't find those to be at odds with each other in any way whatsoever.
Whose fault is it, Chairman Petey, that we don't have this fuller understanding of our history? Certainly history is still taught in school, so why don't we have this understanding?
Well, you know, when people say, oh, it's too large to change, I just disagree. I have no kind of tolerance for defeatism in any form, honestly. And so it's a local decision. If people don't feel their schools, their students are getting in the classroom what they think they should be getting, then there are mechanisms to make their voices heard at the school board, at the state textbook groups. And I think as parents, I say this as a parent of a college freshman, we have our own responsibilities to not only help shape what we hope might happen in school, but also inside our own homes. And the other part about that is, you know, somebody could say, well, fine, but you have to be realistic about people working two jobs, people that are underemployed, you know, books are expensive. And what I would say there is our public library system, if we have a robust public library system, you have access to all the knowledge you may need. And you can turn on public television and you're going to get NEH-funded documentaries. And again, talking about telling a more complete story, when we want to talk about diplomacy, we funded a film called Jazz Ambassadors, and we talk about how the music and the arts and literature were used during the Cold War as a way to kind of bridge cultural differences. We have another documentary, I think it's an incredible documentary, called G.I. Jews, and it was about Jewish soldiers. More than 500,000 Jewish Americans served our country in World War II. And so, and all this, of course, is available online. If you say, well, the younger people don't watch, you know, television, they can stream it on their phones, on their iPads, on their laptops. And of course, you know, and I'm preaching to the choir here, how much knowledge is conveyed through public radio, you know, taxpayer-supported public radio. So I believe it starts with articulating what expectations you have in your community for a well-rounded person.
At the school level and so forth, and then within the
family. Absolutely. Yeah, the school level, the library level. And I know it takes, you know, a good bit of money to support all of these cultural assets, but I believe it is worth it. And I know from a point of economic development, it's essential. I'll give you a statistic. The arts and culture sector in the United States is an $804 billion with a B, industry. That is 4.3% of the nation's GDP. That's extraordinary. More people go to museums a year, some 850 million visits to museums a year, than all the major league sporting events and theme parks combined. And so when you frame it that way, when you think of thousands upon thousands of institutions of higher education added into that equation, it is hard to think of a functioning democracy or a functioning economy separate from the arts and the humanities.
Well, while we're talking about money, we got an email from Aaron who says, if your programs are so great, why do you have to force people to fund it? And Aaron also writes, we are $22 trillion in debt. So I know this is a question you get a lot, Chairman Petey, and Aaron, thank you for raising it. If the programs are so great, there is an argument that they could be or should be funded by private foundations, local cultural institutions. What do you think, Chairman Petey? And thank you, Aaron, for the question.
Well, I think it's an excellent question. I think it's an essential question. I am, by my own nature, somebody who cares deeply for the humanities, and I'm somebody that might be called a more fiscally conservative. So I've been appointed by the last three presidents, so I think, you know, my centralist kind of tendencies are, you know, well established. And I think that's a quite reasonable argument. A couple of things here. One is, for every federal dollar invested by the Humanities Endowment, it generates about $5 in additional economic activity. So it makes good sense in terms of an investment. If we talk about the Arts Endowment, because they sell tickets to events and they have other residual revenue streams, the amount for every arts dollar is 8 to 10, as I understand it. So again, it makes economic sense. Second, we know that when you have a strong cultural sector, a museum, a library, a university, that housing prices stabilize, that restaurants move in, that in those neighborhoods you have a great deal of economic rebirth. So it just makes a difference economically.
Well, and I know you've been, go ahead.
Yeah, no, please. But the other part of it is, so that's all the reasons you would do it. And then getting to the gentleman's question about, well, then why is it a federal concern? Again, I understand there's lots of opinions about that. I will say that when we look at where our grants go, and the Arts Endowment looks at where its grants go, more than a thousand of those counties across the nation have not had any of the largest 500 foundations in the nation invest in them.
So the big guys aren't going into the rural communities.
No, they're not. And so if we say, I believe that large coastal cities, L.A., New York, will fare, San Francisco will fare reasonably well, Chicago, though we make a difference in each of those cities. But rural America, in the absence of the endowment, is going to have a radically different profile. And I'll just give you an example. If you have a museum that needs an environmental assessment of its HVAC system, so that's its air conditioning heating system and
pretty basic stuff,
visitors
and the items in the museum.
Right, and you want to have an elevator where somebody who has compliance with the ADA, the Americans with Disability Act, and you need to put in that elevator to have books on that shelf floor. I don't think a foundation is going to come in and write a $13,000 check, a $70,000 check. It just doesn't happen that way. And we have the statistics to say it doesn't happen that way. The other thing is, some of the things we fund the George Washington papers, the Thomas Edison papers, Willa Cather papers, Mark Twain. If somebody's perspective is that the federal government should have no interest whatsoever and preserving and interpreting the positions, the papers of the founders, I would disagree. So the Smithsonian saved the Star Spangled Banner of Independence. We educated the curators 20 years before that who performed that service.
Well, Aaron, again, thank you for raising the point, because it is one that comes up a lot with this topic. And coming up, Chairman Petey, I'd like to ask you a little bit more about the humanities in rural America, also your own path toward the humanities. It was not a straight and certain path, for sure. All that's coming up, and we'll keep taking your questions and comments. You can send us an email like Aaron did, exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477.
I was wondering.
I'm curious to know more about.
My question is, what is a filibuster?
How does the Electoral College work?
What is required for declaring war?
A majority whip.
Congressional caucuses?
You've got questions? We've got answers. Civics 101, the shame-free podcast refresher course on how our democracy works. There is no such thing as a stupid question. So ask away and subscribe to Civics 101 on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcasts.
Thank you so much. Keep up the excellent work.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, a roundtable of transgender Granite Staters talks about their lives and the changes they've seen. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, National Endowment for the Humanities Chairman John Peedy is here in advance of his visit to the Granite State next week, where he'll be giving the commencement address at Manchester Community College. Send us your emails now to exchange@nhpr.org. Your questions about what the humanities are, the role they play in your community or your life. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And Chairman Peedy, just before the break, we were talking about funding, and I had one more question for you on that. I know you've been asked this before, but it is worth noting that for the third time, the Trump administration's budget has called for the elimination of your agency. Each time this has happened, Congress has had said no and has given you about $150 million, give or take. How does this feel, Chairman Peedy, to have your boss trying to fire you on an annual basis?
Well, thank you. It's an important question. And the philosophy of the administration has been that they don't see the arts and humanities endowments as a funding priority, and they've questioned whether it's an appropriate federal activity, not unlike the individual that wrote in. And I very much understand that position. It's a more libertarian position. And again, I turn to the humanities to understand these traditions myself.
you turn to the humanities enough, to understand why the president wants to eliminate
agency. This is a line of thinking with libertarian thought, for example, not just conservative thought, but libertarian thought that the government should focus on, you know, defense, health, roads, minimum. So it is anchored in a philosophy. And I'll say two things. When I won't talk much about my interviews at the White House, but I think this part I feel comfortable sharing, that when I was asked by the White House to come in for an interview, interview that ultimately led to me being chairman, the president already publicly stated that he was recommending the closure of the agency. And so, one, I wasn't blindsided by that. And I did make it clear that what I do for a living and have done for a living for decades is I build cultural assets, essentially. And they understood that. And I said, if it's not the will of Congress to close it, if they don't recommend that, my intention would be to run it with enthusiasm, to run it, with a strong commitment to prudent use of tax dollars. And they very much understood that. And they said, no, we understand that. So you'll see that, yes, the White House has recommended a closure. That budget has gone to Congress. Congress, for three fiscal years in a row, has disagreed and has actually recommended a budget increase. And each time when the president has signed that into law, I have gone out and presented not just the $155 million budget recommended by Congress, but also signed by the president. And when we have wonderful releases, when we have wonderful media coverage about something we've done, we will send that to the White House. And again, they're positive. They're saying, we're glad to hear that you're using these funds in a responsible manner. And so it's not adversarial. The administration has a different philosophical position than Congress. And my duty is to be responsible to both, to be responsive to both. But both Congress and the White House, really what they expect of me is the same thing, which is to be responsible to the American public and my colleagues in IR.
I want to ask you about your commencement address at Manchester Community College next week. And obviously, I'm not going to ask you to give away everything, Chairman Peedy, but what's the broad message that you'll bring to the students there about the importance of the humanities, especially given that the majority of these students are pursuing degrees in health fields, in business, in technical studies, in industrial fields? Only 18% are studying arts, humanities, and communication. So what's your message for that broad student body?
Sure. Well, one thing I do is I really try to write a new speech for every meaningful occasion, and so so I haven't written it, and but I do have some things I'm going to say. One is I don't want to define success based upon how many people majored in the humanities. What I do think is a more important measure is how many people took humanities classes or were informed by humanistic thinking. So, for example, if somebody majors in business, I think that's great. New Hampshire wants to have young business people entering leadership positions in the state. Having said that, if you want to be a business leader and you do not have grounding in ethics, which is to say the humanities, then I don't know how successful your leadership is going to be in the fullness of your career. If you have technical skills, if you're dealing with artificial intelligence, the kind of things we're seeing with social media, not discerning what is factually true versus what is false, technical knowledge separate from the humanities, from some sense of historical understanding and critical reasoning skills, is a really impoverished idea of technology. And it's notable, for example, when I talk about humanist, that I can mention Einstein, I can mention Edison, I can mention Newton, Da Vinci, Michelangelo. The idea of our scientific innovators lacking humanities knowledge, that was an impossible thought before, let's say, the last generation or so. So I think our responsibility of those of us who are in the humanities is to make sure that those pursuing the sciences and business and fields of that nature have a comprehensive education so they can be successful.
So are you saying, Chairman Petey, that we used to put more of an emphasis on that, the well-rounded person, not just the person who can write code in half an hour but doesn't know anything about how civics works?
I am saying that, and what's interesting is not just, of course, the head of the Humanities Endowment will say the humanities are important. I think
sure.
We all understand that that's going to happen, right? What's fascinating to me is the head of Microsoft says the same thing. You look at a Google listed, I think it was either 6 or 7 key assets they wanted in employees, and it was either 5 out of 6 of those skills were in the humanities or 6 out of 7, whichever it was. I went to Omaha, Nebraska when I started this job. The Union Pacific leadership that I was talking to, they talked about the ability that the technical skills that the engineers or others they needed came out of college with, that knowledge went obsolete so quickly, and they could train them for what they needed. What they could not make up for and weren't willing to invest in, I think, at any large corporate level, is to make up for the lack of 4 years of critical reasoning skills, of knowledge of how economics works, how up cycles and down cycles work. That's unreasonable to expect corporations to make up for such an extraordinary gap. They can, on the other hand, move you from one technical skill to another in the same way that we all casually move from 8-track to cassettes to CDs to, what we have now with streaming. So we move through media in our personal lives very well and very seamlessly. You do not find somebody that lacks foundational knowledge moving through society in the job sector with the same ease.
We did a whole program just a couple weeks ago about the role of the humanities at the community college level. And I'd love your thoughts on that, Chairman Petey. One of the comments that we got on that program, there was wide support for the humanities at the community college level, but some folks did say, look, I am a full-time parent or I am a full-time worker and I'm getting my degree in firefighting or HVAC or whatever. I can't afford the time or the money to also take a course in literature while I am at Manchester Community College or whatever. So I wonder what your thoughts are around that.
Well, I think when people are pursuing academic degrees, that's a great and vital time to have the humanities in their life, particularly if they want to move from an associate degree to a 4-year degree. I think it'll be important, and it would address some of the electives they would need for an advanced degree. But more importantly, it is in the fullness of life, all the ups and downs of lives, jobs dry up, people move away, we experience the loss of loved ones, we have world wars, we have terrible things like 9/11. The processing of life itself, just the weight sometimes of life, that is the humanities. I don't think, you know, I said it earlier that people don't always know when they're experiencing the humanities. When we have a child come into the world and we're singing nursery rhymes, you know, that song, that's history, is passed down often from generations. When we, when somebody passes away, if they have a religious service, you know, whether they're reading out of a Bible or a Quran or another world religion's books, it's poetry. You know, Christian and Jewish people are basically buried with Hebrew poetry when you read out of the Psalms. And so the humanities are always around us. The creative world is always around us. And so if somebody says to me, I can't study that while I'm pursuing this associate degree very narrowly to get certified in a vocational skill, I understand that. I don't have any judgment about that. We need to kind of, it seems to me, move beyond judgment, and we need to have a different kind of conversation, which is to say, if a factory job goes away or a plant moves away, and you want to have a core skill set that allow you to pivot to another career, you're going to be hard-pressed to do that if your writing skills are limited, if your critical reasoning skills are limited. And so I believe the humanities make her a deeper individual, and we know, factually know, that we have stronger, more resilient communities that have a strong cultural sector.
Well, and you're coming at this from personal experience, Chairman Petey. You often tell the story of how you spent the first 3 years of college in a more technical field. You were a pre-med student. Your father was a doctor, so seemed like a good fit. And then you switched, and I love this, as the mother of a college student, you switched to an English major your last year of college. And I'm just imagining that phone call. I'm switching in my last year of college. But here you are now with a long career in literature, editing, writing, history. So it all worked out. But what's the broader lesson, Chairman Petey, of that experience that you might share with the young students that you'll meet next week?
Well, you know, one thing I'll tell them is that it's okay not to have it all figured out at 19 and 22, and for that matter, 32. You know, that at a certain point, though, I think it's okay to acknowledge this isn't who I am. This isn't working out. Not that you've failed, but that's not going to be, my best self is never going to be a doctor, even if I was going to get into med school, which seemed to me rather unlikely. But at the same time, I was, you know, doing poorly and pre-medical classes. I was teaching the LSAT class at night for the Kaplan Company, the largest, you know, testing company, you know, I think of that type in the country. And I decided I actually didn't have any interest in law school either. I just liked the test, and I seemed to have some skill at teaching that test. But it was when I was in a Shakespeare class, in a Southern literature class, that the world came alive to me, and something, you know, it awoken something in me that had always been there. And I just, I didn't know it. I would play high school football, and then I would write poetry at night. And those were both true versions of myself. And it took a long time for me to understand that with my both parents being in medicine, that it wasn't that I loved medicine. I loved community. I loved that people sat down in a room and told the story of their lives to my father in a rural American town. And that when he passed away, actually with a patient's chart in his hand at 58, and they ultimately had to box up all his records, he had 15,000 records in a town of 10,000 people.
Wow, that's a lot. A lot of stories.
And that is rural America, what I love. You know, when I look at what we've funded, I look at New Hampshire when I'm preparing for this. I'm usually talking about the big grants. You know, at Dartmouth, we did almost a $300,000 grant for the Civil Rights Heritage Project, another large grant for a digital humanities grant on silent films, but one caught my eye, $6,000, going back to what these big foundations are never going to fund, $6,000 for grant on Star Island, and it's just to get environmental light monitoring equipment, because this is the collection of the Thaxter Museum, and they just want to look at how they're preserving these archival materials. And somebody says, well, why would you do that at the national level? Well, that's 400 years of the history of the Isles of Shoals. You know, this idea of the endowment really is the large projects that we've talked about, you know, at the universities, both at Dartmouth, University of New Hampshire, but also these small grants. And so, yes, the humanities were something I came to late in college. And then I went to grad school and had the fortune of studying under Bill Ferris, who was President Clinton's NEH chairman. So I'm the only chairman educated by another chairman.
Go ahead. Did you want to finish that thought there?
Oh, lastly, because it's been added to my schedule a little more recently, but on the May 22nd, on Wednesday, we'll actually have a public event at St. Anselm, and there'll be other speakers will be from the New Hampshire Humanities, as well as University of New Hampshire and Dartmouth College. And then at St. Anselm will be introducing that. So that'll be about the role of the public humanities and the NEH. So I particularly wanted to note that. I'm sure at our state humanities partner, you know, they'll have information available about that.
Well, and we will put that information on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. It's already there. So if folks are interested, again, you can go to our website, nhpr.org/exchange, and check out some of the events. There's also other links and information there, too, if you're interested. And Chairman Petey, I wish you safe travels up to New Hampshire next week. I hope we have better weather than we've been having. It's been pretty much like Seattle or London here lately. So we really appreciate you joining us this hour, and safe travels next week. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura. It's been a pleasure.
That's John Petey again. He's chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities. He's also served as a literature grants director at the National Endowment for the Arts and is publisher of the Virginia Quarterly Review. And as he told us, for 7 years, Petey led writing workshops for U.S. troops around the world and on domestic bases. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt, Christina Phillips, and Ali Oshinsky. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.